This is the iGuide Korea Podcast, Episode 2.
Get amped, get stoked, get ready to play. This is the iGuide Korea Podcast, your source for adventure and thrills in Korea's rocking outdoors. Come out and play with us.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the second episode of the iGuide Korea Podcast. I'm Eddie Park, and this podcast is here to take you on a tour of the more extreme side of South Korea. We cover rock climbing, mountain biking, ice climbing, mountaineering, camping, and other awesome outdoor activities, because the world is a playground, so let's go out and play. Let me start with a thank you for those of you who listened to my first ever episode. That was the one on hiking in South Korea. I really appreciate the advice that people have left and the thank yous. Being the first podcast that I had ever done, I was pretty sure there'd be some mistakes I'd make, and the comments that people have left me were very constructive, and I thank you very much again. I'm happy to get that first hurdle behind me, though, and I'm able now to focus on the next episodes, making them much, much better. For those of you who are just joining us, this podcast is part two of a four-part series titled Introducing Korea's Outdoor Adventure. In the last episode, we covered the more popular activity in Korea, which was hiking. In this episode, we cover climbing, as in rock and ice climbing and mountaineering. In part three, which is the next episode, we'll cover biking. And in the last episode of the series, part four, we'll talk about water sports, focusing specifically on paddling. Well, let's get to the topic at hand, and that's climbing. In this episode, we look at the Korean climbing scene, its history, its present, its future outlooks. I'll suggest some places to climb, and I'll give you the resources you need to start climbing. In terms of global achievements, Koreans have had the most success in climbing. Now, when I say climbing, I'm talking about very technical stuff. I'm talking about rock climbing, ice climbing, and mountaineering. These activities require a deep understanding of rope work and safety measures in order not to fall to one's demise or not to be seriously injured. Now, that may seem to be a bit of a morbid intro to this climbing episode, but that is a reality. With every piece of climbing gear you buy, there comes this little tag, and this little tag has a disclaimer on it. And the disclaimer sounds a little like this. Technical rock climbing is inherently dangerous. Our products are for rock climbing, bouldering, and mountaineering only. Any person using our gear in any manner is personally responsible for learning the proper techniques and good judgment. We strongly recommend that every climber seek instruction by a qualified professional. You are responsible for knowing and respecting our product's capabilities and limitations. Always know the maintenance and use history of your equipment and destroy retired gear to prevent further future use. The use of secondhand equipment is strongly discouraged. You are responsible for your own actions and decisions. Failure to follow these warnings can result in severe injury or death. Ba-ba-ba. Yeah, well, that's the disclaimer. That's an actual true disclaimer from the Metolius website, a popular American climbing equipment manufacturer. Now, I'm not trying to scare you off climbing. I'm actually going to tell you how awesome it is in this podcast. But I want to make sure that I don't make any disillusions that technical climbing can be approached in the same manner as, you know, as a pickup basketball game or going down the bunny slopes at a ski hill. It's different. There are serious consequences when you make small mistakes. The American Alpine Club, actually, releases an annual journal called Accidents in North American Mountaineering. The journal analyzes the year's most significant accidents in order to prevent others from making the same mistake. So you're supposed to read it and learn from it. The risk to life and limb is inherently part of the climbing activity, and that risk is what makes climbing so addictive? Yes. Let me explain. A superficial view of this addiction, often, you know, people think about tank top adrenaline junkies taking huge falls. And that may be the most common reason people try to start climbing at first. Getting that adrenaline rush where the anxiety grips your body and your mind and your body shaking uncontrollably and you grip the rock like a vice and a million thoughts just surge into your head in the blink of an eye. It's a feeling that not everyone might like, but other people really get off on it. But here's the thing. When you're able to overcome that feeling and you're able to control it and accept the rush, That's the awesome thing. That's where you feel like king of the world. Let me describe it in another way. For me, the addiction is not really the main thing, the main reason why I climb anymore. I've been climbing for a while now, I'd say over 17 years. I don't really know how many years. Actually, 20 now. Yeah, 20. But it's part of the experience. It's part of a more meaningful experience. Let me tell you what I'm talking about. For me, climbing has built a sense of self-confidence and self-reliance that I couldn't get anywhere else. When you're hanging from your fingertips and you're stepping tiptoe on dime edges and you're looking at the next hold, that hold seems miles away. And in your mind, you don't know if you can reach that next handhold. And in your mind, you think you're going to fall. And in your mind, you're creating all these weird realities, like what if you fall and you fall backwards and you hit your head? What if you fall and you hit that ledge, you're going to break your ankles? You put all these things in your head. All these things happen in your head. So many things just rush into your mind, keeping you from the next goal, from the next handhold. And that's the adrenaline. The adrenaline's got that fight or flight reaction, and that's a flight reaction that we're talking about. And so basically it's telling you just close your eyes and let go and just give up. That's what can happen when you let the adrenaline take control of you. The awesome thing is when you take control of the adrenaline, and that's the fight option, that's the fight instinct and with adrenaline. And what that does is that with all this superpower you get from the adrenaline, your mind just gets clearer and you start being able to do things that you really did not think you could do. You defy all the fear and self-doubt. And for that moment, there is just the climb, nothing else. And you keep reaching upward and you keep raising your legs and you keep stepping up higher and you keep reaching upwards. And soon you're at the top with the world beneath your feet. It's an unbeatable feeling. And that's the addictive part. And you feel like you can do anything and you can take on anything. Yes, yes. In many cases, you do fall trying. But you fall with your eyes wide open, you know? You're cursing the whole way down, and you want to do it again. For me, some of the climbs I've done have been dramatic productions, where I'm so close to getting the crux move, but falling at the same spot over and over again. And then there's another whole set of life lessons to be learned from that. Like, learn to approach problems without the burden of past failures lurking in your mind. Believing you can do it because no one else can get you up that climb. You know, all that really good, healthy, metaphysical stuff. Climbing is zen. Climbing is great. So despite the inherent dangers in climbing, there are things that climbers get from the experience. And that's the reason why we come back to it. And we learn so much about ourselves and just what we can do. But let's get back to climbing and climbing in Korea. And we're going to take a look at some Korean climbing history. And Korea actually has a very interesting climbing history that most Westerners aren't aware of. For example, did you know the rock climbing shoe company 510 based its early shoe molds on the shape of a Korean's feet? More accurately, one climber named Young Chu. Young Chu in the 70s and 80s was a Yosemite climbing bum. He started making motorcycle bags to make some extra money, and this eventually led to shoemaking. It was around this time when he was into shoes that Charles Cole, the founder of 510, worked out a deal where Young would make the early models for the company's rock climbing shoes. And so he based the lasts or molds on his feet. You know, I've always wondered why 510s, out of all the climbing shoes out there, had always fit my feet so perfectly. And now I know. Young Chu probably has the same wide Korean feet as I do. Anyways, after he stopped working with 510, Young Chu started his own climbing brand called Mad Rock. And that, as many people probably already know, has developed into a successful climbing gear company, offering products from award-winning shoes to hardware like carabiners. And another climbing equipment founder that has ties to Korea is the legendary Yvon Chouinard, the founder of Chouinard Equipment that later became Black Diamond, and the founder of the high-end clothing company Patagonia. So Yvonne came to Korea as part of his U.S. Army duties, and he did a tour in Korea for 2 years, from 1962 to 1964, and it was based out of Incheon. Apparently, according to him, he was not so fond of the Army life, but he did love the climbing near Seoul, especially in Insubong, where he has established two classic routes called, funny enough, Shwinard A, which is 5'10", and Shwinard B, around 5'8". Those are some interesting bits of climbing history I never knew of until I came to Korea. But let's go back even further to 1926, where on Insubong in Bukhansan National Park, which is near Seoul, a certain Mr. Archer, who was the British vice consul to Korea at the time, and a Korean man named Im Mu, actually the Korean's participation is unconfirmed, but anyways, some reports say with this man, with this Korean gentleman called Im Mu, they made the first modern rock climbing ascent in Korea. And that was probably the beginning of Europe's large influence on the development of Korean alpinism. However, Korea's global mountaineering history isn't as long as their European counterparts. According to Korean mountaineers, the reason why Koreans didn't start international alpine ascents or mountaineering ascents until much later was because Koreans were restricted from leaving the country during the Japanese colonization, which ended in 1945. And during the Korean War, they couldn't go. And by the time the Korean War had ended, the country was too poor for anyone to leave. However, since then, Korean mountaineers have established new routes of the biggest mountains in the world, including Yongsuk Park's route on the southwest face of Everest, which was called, simply enough, the Korean route. Korea is tied, actually, right now with Italy for having the most climbers summiting all 14 8,000-meter peaks. The five Korean climbers who have completed this extraordinary feat are Yongsuk Park, Hong Gil-eom, Wang Yong-han, Jae-soo Kim, Chang-ho Kim. And Chang-ho actually has set the record for the fastest ascent of all 14 8,000-meter peaks. At the beginning, however, Korea's global mountaineering presence was not so successful. It was actually quite fatal. The first attempt on an 8,000-meter Himalayan peak was in 1971 when Chung-sup Kim and his team attempted to climb Manaslu, 8,156 meters. And unfortunately, one member fell to his death on that expedition. In the same year, an expedition to Lhotse Shar, 8,252 meters, by the Korean Alpine Federation, failed due to a snowstorm. And then the next year, Chung-sup Kim's second attempt on Manaslu ended in the death of five team members and nine Sherpas. So after this string of tragedies, the Korean Alpine Club just stopped all Himalayan expeditions. And they decided to send 13 climbers to the French National Climbing and Skiing School in Chamonix for training. And it was good that they did, because this training brought in newer and safer climbing techniques to the country. However, even with the overseas training, Korea's top mountaineers have continued to perish. Mi Yong-go, who became one of the first people to climb three 8,000-meter peaks in a single season, had a fatal descent on Nanga Parbat after reaching the summit in 2009. And in 2011, the remarkable Yongsuk Park and his party went missing and are presumed dead during their attempt on a new route on Annapurna. Some say the fatalities are partially because of a tradition of risk-taking among Korean mountaineers, whose passion and determination to get to the top sometimes overshadows proper preparation. But others have also pointed out that other countries have had similar tragedies, and they believe that if you spend enough time in those big mountains that are full of avalanches, that are full of thin ice, falling rocks, sub-zero temperatures, and blinding storms, those mountains will take you for their own. And in my opinion, that's true too. Whatever the reason, though, it's tragic. Primarily, it's tragic for the family and friends. And it's also tragic for the younger generation of mountaineers in Korea who lose these valuable mentors. And I feel it's important to remember and honor the achievements of the past mountaineers and the present as they continue to create a legacy for future generations. So here's a list of some of the more notable accomplishments. As mentioned before, the late Mi Yong-go was also known as Misango. Along with Jesu Kim, they were the first people to summit 3 8,000-meter peaks in a single season. Incredible. Myung was also an accomplished sport climber, winning medals in international competitions like the X Games. Actually, the first time I ever met her, and the only time I ever met her, unfortunately, was at the X Games in San Diego, where she took silver, I believe, from Katie Brown, just behind Katie Brown. Then there's the late and legendary Young-suk Park. This man is one of the greatest athletes and adventurers that has ever lived. He's the only person in history to accomplish the True Explorer's Grand Slam. And what that entails is all 14 8,000-meter peaks, the seven summits, and both poles, north and south. He has broken records by climbing 6 8,000-meter peaks in 1 year and trekking to the South Pole on a self-sufficient expedition in 44 days. Additionally, if that wasn't enough, he's established the new route on the technical southwest face of Everest. This guy has seriously done it all. And for the newer generation of mountaineers, there's Chang-ho Kim. On May 19th, 2014, he broke the record for completing all 14 8,000-meter peaks without oxygen in the fastest time. 7 years, 10 months, and 6 days. And he's still an active climber today. Then there's Chiyoung An, who's an IGK team member. He's focused on doing first ascents in alpine style. His ambition has produced 2 Golden Ice Axe Asia Awards, or Pile d'Or Asia. One was for his first ascent of Himjeong, 7,140 meters, which was at the time the highest unclimbed peak in Nepal. And his second Pile d'Or Asia was for his first ascent on Gashbrum 5, 7,147 meters in 2014. So the future of Korean alpinism continues to look bright as the younger generation continue this new legacy. And where do these fearless explorers train in Korea? Well, you might have noticed that Korea doesn't have the highest mountains out there. So to simulate high altitude, much of the training will happen in the winter at Insubong in Bukhansan National Park. I've mentioned it a few times. And Soraksan National Park. And what's really great about Korea is that because of the topography, you really feel like you're in high altitude when it's winter because you have all these rocky outcrops and you have these spires and you have these domes. And so it really makes a good low altitude training ground for the high altitude stuff. Now, from the very big mountains to the smaller mountains, well, at least to very steep cliffs, we come to the rock climbing section of this podcast. And like Myung Go, many of the top mountaineers in Korea have come from a solid rock climbing background, and Korea is a great place to rock climb. What I love about the country is that within a 200-kilometer radius or two-hour drive from my home in Daejeon, the middle of Korea, I can access so many different types of rock, from fine-grained granite to like coarse conglomerate, and I can access about 8 different climbing areas. Korea has so much rock. One rock climbing guidebook for Korea lists 64 separate climbing areas, and many of the areas are very accessible with short hikes to get to the base of a crag. But there are also hidden gems that you have to sweat and make an effort to get to, and I love these hidden crags because they just seem to rise out of nowhere. You're like you're hiking in through the forest and you're on this trail, and all of a sudden you look up and boom, there's this crag. And the best part, there are usually no crowds. And that is something you do have to deal with climbing in Korea, especially at the more popular, easily accessible areas that are close to the city. You have to deal with crowds. So for me, weekdays is popular areas and weekends are these kind of hidden adventure climbing time. Now, here's a quick rundown of the general geological makeup of the country. Now, this is really brief, okay? So I'm no geologist, but this is the trend. In the northern parts of Korea, you'll find many of your popular granite and multi-pitch climbs. Insubong, where the likes of Chris Sharma, Yvon Chouinard have climbed, is located near the heart of Seoul, and it's very accessible by subway and bus. Soraksan National Park, which was designated a Biosphere Preservation District by UNESCO in 1982, is a beautiful place, and it offers a more wilderness experience with stunning summit views that include the